Natural Resources Committee to order. Good morning to everyone. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2881. We're going to start with that one first, Representative Wayne Krieger. We are so honored to have you in our presence, Representative, so we wanted to kind of move that up. Why don't you tell us what we need to know?
Madam Chair and Committee Members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And I see Vice Chair Rogan smiling at me. I think it's the first time I've been in a committee with you, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
For the record, I am Wayne Krieger, State Representative from District 1, which is Southern Oregon on the coast. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2881, the proposed delisting of the Aleutian Canadian Goose. You have a letter dated 4/11/05 from four landowners that are having their land devastated in the north part of Curry County, southern Coos County. Two of these are past customers of mine from my prior life, if you understand what I mean, but they've become great constituents and friends, and I enjoy working with them on this issue. Also, you have a fact sheet that shows a population growth from 1970 of approximately 150 to 600 birds to the 2005 estimated population of 90 to 115,000 birds. We, in fact, have been successful in recovering the Aleutian goose population.
Representative Krieger, we're joined by the Honorable Representative Bob Jensen. Welcome.
Thank
I didn't
you.
Mean to interrupt him. I just wanted to acknowledge. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
They need now to be managed and their population controlled to fit the habitat that they have when they come up the Oregon coast. Last spring, I visited the Mackenzie Ranch north of Langlois to observe what conditions were there. I wanted to see it for myself. At the time, there were an estimated 50,000 birds. Most were utilizing a 400 to 500 acre area, and they had been there for about 3 to 4 weeks. The pasture had been devastated. In fact, if you and I, or the landowner, Mr. McKenzie, had allowed cattle or sheep to concentrate and to destroy soil and water quality to the extent I observed, we would have been in violation of the CAFO regulations, which is the confined animal feeding operations. There's no doubt it was that bad. As you will hear, I believe, from some of the testimony and some of the papers that you have, California has delisted the Aleutian goose and has returned to hunting them as part of their management of this species. They are reportedly considering increasing their season and bag limit this next coming year. In closing, I just believe that it is past time for Oregon to delist and start managing the Aleutian goose. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. Any questions for Representative Krieger? Thank you. Representative Jensen?
Excuse me, because I'd like to get back to committee if I can, please.
You sure can. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Jensen, State Representative from Pendleton, and House District 58. And I want to thank the Chair and members of the committee for hearing this bill. It is a real problem. Species is a real problem for us in the state, and the important thing is in relationship to it, the species is by any definition of recovery recovered. Further, as if the department is testifying, I think you will find out that there is nothing that they can do to go through any normal delisting process to delist this particular species. At least that is the opinion that we've had from the state attorney general. The reason for that is that this species, along with a number of other species, were grandfathered in to the Oregon endangered species list when Oregon first enacted its Endangered Species Act. As a consequence, And you may need, if you were interested, you know, and need to go there, talk to the Attorney General or get the testimony from the Attorney General on this. But as a consequence of all of this, the only way that we can delist this species is by an act of the legislature. If the department had been able, or if the department were able to delist it, I think they would have initiated those actions long ago. And so, since, as you've heard from Representative Krieger, the species exists in abundance now, not just the delisting numbers, but in abundance to a point they've become a pest and a nuisance, it is imperative that the legislature fulfill its responsibilities, as I would see it, and take the action to delist the species. And I thank you for your indulgence. I thank you very much for hearing this bill. And I would certainly try to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Any questions? Wow, you must have one. Representative Roblin.
I'll ask this one. Since it is listed, I could ask this to the state department. It means we cannot harass them either.
Thank you, Representative Chairman Smith and Representative Roblin. Thank you for that question. Since it is a listed species, we run some risk of taking, if and when we harass them, taking, that is, killing, you know, some of them, and therefore run some risks of, you know, going astray as far as the laws are concerned. So the risks are somewhat greater, maybe, than the benefits that might be received from that. And that's a good point, and I'm sorry I didn't make it, and I'm glad you asked the question.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Ron Englund and Roy Elliker next from the Fish and Wildlife. I want to come up and give us all the great facts on the goose. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, currently the Deputy Director under Director Lindsey Ball. On my right, Mr. Ron Englund, Wildlife Division Administrator. And I do have some prepared testimony. I can move briefly through, Madam Chair, and then take questions on this. This is an important bill for ODF&W, and appreciate the opportunity to come and give comments on it, and also appreciate the support Representative Jensen's been on this particular issue, because it is an issue currently for us in the state of Oregon right now. Currently, as she stated, Aleutian Canada geese were listed in 1987 on the Oregon ESA list. At the time, Aleutians were not in very good shape, and the population objective was only 7,500 birds, and they were not there yet. But in 2001, they're much above 7,500, and here today in 2005, they're 10 times over their original population objective set by the federal government back in the mid-80s. Currently, a small population does winter in the Tillamook area, and that's been why legally it's a difficult issue for the state to use the normal delisting criteria. And I'll let Mr. Englund speak specifically to the statute, on the ESA statute on that. But originally, what we had in Oregon was just a very small group of 100-150 birds originating in the Samedi Islands, which is part of the Aleutian chain, or nearby, I understand. Representative Boquist has probably been there.
Yep.
And that population was fairly steady at 100-150 birds in the Tillamook area for a number of years. But what's happened is, overall, the feds, you know, sometimes get into ESA work and get into this thing, whether you're splitting them up or lumping them together. The feds decided in early 2001 that they'd lump together all the Aleutian geese, particularly since they were doing so well under management, and they federally delisted them in 2001. And what we have now is a number of these geese, or most all of them now, are coming through Oregon in the last few years and vastly increasing, where last year I think we had 50 to 75,000 geese during the spring migration in Curry County for a number of weeks, and they did cause some real damage to some of the local landowners down there. So because of the fact, though, that we have this small group of Smedey Island birds, and legally, the way ESA is written, is the Oregon ESA is tailored towards animals that are full-time resident species, and is tailored towards the state taking actions to ensure reproductive success. Because we can't control really either one with a bird that just comes and winters here on the Oregon coast at a very low level, it's been a problem. When we've gone to the AG's office and spent quite a bit of time and money trying to figure out a way prior to this bill to remove these animals from the list so we can have much better management options for them. But routinely, the response has been that the way the statute is currently written, and with the Smedey Island birds being in such a small number, that was a problem for the commission to move ahead to delisting them. Anyway, if the bill would pass, it allow us to work more proactive within the Pacific Flyway Council and with California and Alaska to implement more proactive management, perhaps some hunting seasons, and some more effective hazing to alleviate or reduce the damage here in Curry County, and allow some additional recreation opportunities for the public as well. I did also want to go on the record in the last paragraph of page 2 that just very recently the American Ornithological Union changed the scientific name of Aleutian Canada geese. So probably, Madam Chair, what I'm thinking is maybe when we get to the Senate, unless you'd like to take the time here, we might want to amend this bill with the correct scientific name to make sure there's no issues on that.
Okay. I think that's a good suggestion.
That ends my prepared testimony.
Thank you. Any questions? If you want to go ahead, Mr. Anglin, and then we'll have any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. There are a couple of things I'd like to add to before I get into specifically the delisting portion of it. First off, that Oregon has already put the technical representatives of the Pacific Flyway on notice that Oregon would have to oppose liberalization of seasons in California that could have an impact on Oregon landowners. And that came as quite a surprise to them because normally the states do work very cooperatively in trying to address landowner damage in the other states and support other state season recommendations. But we felt that because of the potential shifting of birds north into Oregon, it would be something that we could not support further liberalization of seasons in California. Secondly, that we have been working closely with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the landowners to obtain harassment permits for the landowners on the South Coast. And the Fish and Wildlife Service is supportive of that. Excuse me. They are actually the ones that would have to authorize the harassment, but we have worked through our state processes to help the landowners secure the proper fire marshal permits for handling explosive devices, and then we are making materials available to those landowners under those permits from the feds and from the state fire marshal's office to assist them with harassment of the birds. Where it gets sticky for us as an agency specifically is in 496.176 sub 3, where it specifically states that the commission shall determine that the natural reproductive potential of the species is in danger of failure to limited population due to limited population numbers. And because the Smedey Island birds reside solely in Oregon, we have to, before we could delist the Aleutians as a whole, we have to be able to ensure that the Smedey Island portion of the overall Aleutian population is not any longer in danger of reproductive failure. Unfortunately, it is the one group of birds within the whole mega population that is in some risk of reproductive failure. We've been working cooperatively through the flyway to try and increase and reestablish those populations, but at this point in time, they are at risk. Because they're at risk, and we cannot ensure or we cannot take any actions to really make any changes or differences in Alaska, it is impossible for us to move through our process for delisting. And it's been extremely frustrating because it's a transient species and it's really something that was added to the list that we have no real way to influence overall survival. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this one of the species that was discussed with the UPIC and in regards to the Flyway Council issues here a couple weeks ago we participated in?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, we did have a subtopic discussion about the Aleutians. The UPICs do rely on the Aleutians for a source of food, and they have been very cooperative in working with the southern states to address population concerns and move towards a delisting. So there were discussions going on. Unfortunately, there's just this one subpopulation that we still have the problems with, and the UPICs are working with Alaska and the service to address that.
Call it, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So, what did you say in your report against this?
The UPICs? Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, it's not an issue to them. They would be supportive, I would guess, of the state delisting. They've been supportive of the federal delisting. And with the population now at 78,000 birds and climbing, they're harvesting birds and ready to harvest birds as part of their subsistence needs.
Representative Roblin, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's pretty much the same. I think I got the answer now, but because I was having the same issue. With this bill passing, can you still work with the small population of 150 birds that are up in Tillamook and work with managing these birds?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, very easily we can do that.
That was the good answer. Any further questions? What would be the, I have a question, Mr. Ellicker, what would be the change on to the scientific, do you have that?
I have the now correct name in my written testimony, Madam Chair, but the bill, I think the bill right now, as written, does speak to identify the goose by its scientific name. Yes, on page 2 of the bill, line 44,
right.
It does speak that to the scientific name of the goose, and as we found out yesterday, that has just very recently been changed by the ornithological, if I can pronounce that, union.
Yeah. Glad you said that, not me.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you. But I think that answers my question. Thanks for the question. Thank you very much. We have Justin. Justin Martin of the Nature Conservancy. And he's the last one I have signed up to testify. If there's anybody else. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. We are here to support House Bill 2881. The Nature Conservancy supports the removal of the Aleutian Canada goose from Oregon's list of threatened and endangered species. House Bill 2881 is a simple technical fix to address this anomaly in current law and to allow for more effective management of the Aleutian Canada goose's growing population throughout the Pacific Flyway. The decision to delist by the federal government was based on sound science under the criteria defined in the Endangered Species Act, and we are supportive of that decision. As long as this species remains on the state threatened and endangered list, agency natural resource managers are not able to take appropriate actions to manage those populations and to reduce potential negative impacts from large local assemblages of the birds. Again, on behalf of the Nature Conservancy of Oregon, we are here today in support of House Bill 2881. Thank you.
Justin, any questions? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have Ed Johnston signed up. And Stephen Perforce. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ed Johnston, Lane County. And I have to support this bill mainly because I'm one of those subsistence hunters, fishermen, that I rely on these resources for my main food source. I don't look it, but I am totally disabled. Half my neck's titanium. I have 3 discs going in the spinal cord, 7 blown discs in my back. So this is the main diet and main source, you know, and us too. Hunting and fishing keeps people with some pride and dignity instead of being totally relied on a system. But we forget that because we're more concerned about relying on other people's employment than we are about the people of the state of Oregon and the dignity and pride And so we need to delist this so these people can still put food on their table.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Not seeing none. Thank you. Mr. Kafoury?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafoury. I'm here representing the Wildlife Society of Oregon, Oregon chapter of the National Wildlife Society. The Wildlife Society is not an advocacy organization like the Nature Conservancy. We are a professional society, scientific society of wildlife biologists. As such, we are concerned about bringing science to the discussions that this legislature has when it makes policy decisions about natural resources. We agree in substance with this bill. We think that the Alaska Aleutian goose should be delisted. We have a problem with the process. We feel that listing and delisting should be a scientific decision made through the administrative process and not a legislative, a political decision made through the legislative process. What we'd like to see in this particular instance is more flexibility given statutorily to ODFW to get us to get out of that box. And we've talked about this with the legislature for the last couple of years. We've suggested language that says where the state has no role in protecting the animal, then they can administratively delist it. And that would be a decision made by ODFW. Unfortunately, every time we bring in some suggestions to this bill, then wolves come in and salmon come in and interest groups come and we get a bill that's this long because everybody wants to add their amendments to it. If this bill were very cleanly drafted and said nothing but giving this department, Fish and Wildlife, the authority to delist where they have no ability, state has no ability to protect wildlife, and can't do anything about what happens in their life cycle, then we would be very supportive of the bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Ford? Seeing none, thank you very much. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2881. Committee, I'd like to move this bill. It doesn't have a subsequent list.
No, Madam Chair, the bill has no fiscal or revenue impact and therefore has no subsequent list.
Okay. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2881.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2881 be moved to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. I have a motion to move House Bill 2881 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. From the committee. Representative Wilkman.
I want to make sure that we send a clear message to the Senate that they need to amend this bill to get the proper scientific name in it when it gets to the Senate. With that, I think I also like Mr. Kafoury's idea of coming up with some language that would allow some of these delistings to happen at a crucial point. I don't know if this is the bill at the time, but I think the idea of giving the department the authority to do that makes some sense to me. I think there's some good science out there that would indicate certain birds use us as they go back and forth, but we really have no control over their existence. So it would be good to do something like that. But right now, I support this bill.
Thank you. I think that's well put, too. And the problem is, like Mr. Kafoury said, you know, everybody gets into that language, and it makes it very difficult to get a bill through this process. So this bill is very straightforward and addresses this. Do you have
Is there a reason we can't wait to do these amendments so that when we send over a bill that's our stamp of approval?
The only amendment that I see that we need to do is change the scientific name, and that can be done on the Senate side, as we noted. And so that's not a major amendment. It would take, I just don't know that we have enough time in this session left to do those kind of delays. So that would be my concern on that. Yeah. But duly noted. Any further comments? Representative Wilkins?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think discussion around the scientific, one is I'm concerned that, you know, there won't be time, and two, discussion around the scientific thing we need.
Yeah.
We might even, I think Oregon Fish and Wildlife might find that they might want to leave both of them in before it's over, because just because the, whomever the committee was, made this decision doesn't mean everybody's adopted it quite yet. So that might take, I think the intent is very clear. And again, I'm really concerned that, you know, the Senate's going to go home before we. Because I do have a concern about sending legislation out like that, because I've been bitten recently. As Representative Haas.
I think we all have been.
Thank you.
Without any further comments, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer?
Yes.
Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Burley?
Yes.
Representative
Hart?
Yes.
Representative
Rowland?
Aye.
Representative Sumner?
Yes.
Chair votes aye. Having received the required number of votes, we've passed House Bill 2881 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'll have Representative Jensen be the chair. And if the Representative Krieger would like to be the co-chair.
Okay.
We can certainly inquire. Thank you. I'll close the work session on 2880. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2529. And Patrick, why don't you give us a quick? I forgot to do that on the last also.
No problem.
You can cover them both.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2529 specifies that public lands that are used for wildlife management purposes are to be made accessible to hunting, directs the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to avoid making management decisions that result in a net loss of wildlife management areas that are open to and available to hunting, and directs the Commission to report annually to the legislature on the acreage of public lands that are accessible. On your desk in front of you, you'll find testimony from Representative Krieger. He was unable to stay for this bill, but he left some testimony on that. Also, in your packets, you'll find Dash 1 amendments, which were provided by Rod Harder, who will be speaking to the bill, and also testimony from two sources, which was received by committee staff, Kelly Peterson of the Humane Society and, I believe, Sally Mackler of Humane USA.
Thank you, Patrick. And since Representative Krieger couldn't be here, he did leave that information, and he asked Rod Harder to present it for him. So if I could come forward.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Rod Harder. I'm the Oregon lobbyist for the National Rifle Association, and I'm going to present two pieces of testimony. First, that for Representative Krieger, which lays out what the bill does, and then a very short version of my own. For Representative Krieger, it is a well-known fact that hunters and sportsmen contribute significant amounts of money to the Oregon economy each year. Sadly, hunter numbers are decreasing. This is a many-faceted problem, but one of the most prevalent complaints is the lack of hunting access. HB 2529 is a very straightforward piece of legislation. It directs the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to conduct its management of public lands in a manner that will result in no net loss of those lands to hunter access. Plain words, if the commission closes 100 acres of public lands to hunting access, then they have to find 100 acres somewhere else to open up. The bill does not require that it be the same type of land or habitat, only that it be at least the same amount. Bill is amended by the Dash 1 amendments also requires that the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife report annually to the legislature the number of acres of public land used for wildlife management that have been closed to hunting by the commission action and the reasons for each closure, and the amount of acres that have been opened to hunting by the commission action. I believe that this bill takes a small step towards keeping existing hunter access from shrinking as it has been for too many years. I urge your support. And that concludes Representative Krieger's testimony. We asked Representative Krieger to bring this bill forward because hunting access continues to shrink. Private lands continue to be closed to hunter access for a variety of reasons. Dissatisfaction with the Wolf Plan has recently caused some eastern Oregon landowners to take their lands away from public access. And that's not a criticism of them, it's just a statement of fact. Other landowners find it necessary for a variety of reasons to charge fees for access to their land. Each of these actions make public land access increasingly important to the Oregon hunting community. We ask Representative Krieger to sponsor this legislation to take a step towards ensuring that the amount of public lands open to hunting does not decrease. We thank him for sponsoring the bill and for previously outlining its contents and goals. There was some concern on the Department of the Oregon on the, there was some concern on the part of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that the agency would be required to inventory all public lands each year for purpose of reporting to the legislature. The Dash 1 amendments that you have before you make it clear that ODF&W only has to report on those lands on which the commission takes action. Currently, the Access and Habitat Board, which is a commission appointed by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, has an ongoing project to review those public lands that are currently landlocked by private lands and to negotiate for access to them. This bill should dovetail very nicely with that program. It's a relatively simple bill that can have significant impact on Oregon's hunting future, and we urge your support. I do want to comment, I have not seen Kelly Peterson's testimony, but I have seen testimony of Sally Mackler. And if you look at lines 19 and 20 of the bill, that pretty much renders that testimony from Ms. Mackler moot, because it says the commission is not required. And we put that in there specifically to avoid getting in violation of 496. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and present our testimony, and I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have if I can.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Any questions? Representative Hass?
I'm not clear what the problem is, at least the measurable problem. When you say there's hunting, it's shrinking. I mean, what do you have any facts and figures to substantiate some of that could say here's the direct problem and here's the solution?
Madam Chair, Representative Hass, I think when agency gets up here, they can give you a perfect example. I'm going to give you a brief answer to that question. In Summer Lake, they're going to soon be removing a certain portion of that hunting land that's available for purposes of drawing geese somewhere else or waterfowl somewhere else. When they remove that 200 acres or however much it may be, then we're asking that they replace it somewhere else. It doesn't have to be duck and goose habitat. It just has to be more acreage that will replace that they're taking off the market.
Thank you. We are, Representative Hass, we are going to have Fish and Wildlife Testimony.
Yeah.
So maybe they can answer that question for you better. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Al Elkin, the Oregon Hunters Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. Mr. Harder pretty much covered what I was going to say in relation to the purpose of the bill. We support the bill, and I do believe that because the commission and the director have established the Access and Habitat Program and its direction on locating access, that this will fit nicely with that program. So I see them working in conjunction together. In our hearing on Monday in Sisters, we talked about they've already opened up over 2 million acres of land, and I think this just gives them another tool to use. So we support the bill and the Dash 1 amendments. That's all I have. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Elkin?
Thank you
very much. Ron Anglin and Roy Elliker. Well, good morning again.
Good morning again. For the record, Roy Elliker, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Mr. Ron Anglin, Wildlife Fish Administrator. Madam Chair, speaking to House Bill 2529, Department has no problem with the bill whatsoever, we would support the Dash 1 amendments. However, to be clear, that it's land that our commission has some purview over. And otherwise, we were afraid that, you know, we'd be having to census the Forest Service, the BLM, Department of Forestry, and trying to keep track of all public lands in the state. And so that's why we asked for the Dash 1 amendment, to clarify that that's not what we're looking for. And I appreciate the work of Rod Harder, now Elkins, and others on this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Franklin?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, once again, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Perhaps to give you some perspective, Mr. Harder is correct that we are looking at some changes on some of our wildlife management areas to start moving around some of the refuge areas that currently are closed. And what we would do is move the refuge area to an area that's been open to hunting and create a new refuge area someplace else, so that you kind of don't get birds accustomed to a certain area that they go to all the time. Probably the bigger, request that the agency get is a continuing conflict of people that are living in rural areas alongside like the Rogue River, Umpqua, things like that, that are continually requesting that the department close hunting on the river because of discharge of firearms, and continually asking that we close access to hunting on BLM lands adjacent to new subdivisions that are out in rural areas in western Oregon, etc. And we also have several wildlife management areas that are located very close to the urban growth boundaries of several cities in western Oregon and to some extent eastern Oregon, that we get continuing pressure that people want us to close hunting on these wildlife areas and only provide for recreational access to those areas for non-consumptive users. So we're continually getting requests like that for lands that we manage and also for Forest Service and BLM lands. So this would obviously give us some very clear direction on how we are to handle those requests.
Yeah, I have a quick question. I wanted to ask, we haven't had a fiscal statement issued yet. Do you see any fiscal impact?
With the Dash 1 amendment, that we don't see any particular problem with the fiscal.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Pat?
Well, I was just wondering what happens in your example, Rogue River. People say that they don't like this activity, so then how does this play out? So then you do what? You close it off, or you ignore them, or what do you do?
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, the way we have typically handled that is at the local level, have our district folks meet with landowner associations, concerned landowners, and try and determine, is the concern really about hunting or is it really about discharge of firearms? And if it is a public safety issue and a discharge of firearms, then we typically refer them back to the county, and whether the county wants to take any ordinance action relative to regulating discharge of firearms in areas like that. From a hunting standpoint, we try and screen out whether it really is a public safety or it's simply the fact that somebody does not like hunting.
Okay. And then, if I can.
Sure.
And if you decide that, okay, this is going to be off limits to hunting, do you ever make that decision to land like that, or are you just funded to the counties?
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, in recent times we have not made that decision. We've not been able to come to any kind of agreement or compromise with the landowners or the hunting community in situations like that. But typically, when you really get down to it, it is people objecting to hunting or objecting to discharge of firearms, but they use hunting as a way or an excuse to get there to try and close the discharge of firearms in an area. And unfortunately, it does not stop miscellaneous people from discharging firearms to take care of the public safety problem that they might think exists.
Also, Madam Chair, Representative Haas, the other issue that sometimes rises is really what folks are concerned about more than anything are illegal activities, poaching activities or shooting after dark, things like that. And so we also might work with Oregon State Police to target some additional law enforcement time into those areas where we're receiving those complaints, where the landowners didn't realize that the behavior they're objecting to is frankly illegal behavior under current law anyway. And so that's another way we try and work these things out, if that's the case.
Okay. I guess I'm still wondering how big of a problem this is, and, you know, how many acres are we talking about, to what extent this is even a problem, and because this feels a little bit like an unfunded mandate, and I just don't see a problem. I mean, if there's a problem, give me some statistics, some figures, some explanation.
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, I can't give you kind of the scope of the problem. As you're aware and have heard, pretty much from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, we like hunting. Hunting is a viable part of an activities that people in the state do. So we do pretty much work hard to ensure that in lands, at least that we manage, hunting remains a viable option, a recreational activity. So I can't say that there's a large problem that this bill is addressing right now currently. However, as more and more folks move into different areas of the state, we do have more requests for some restrictions on hunting and those kind of things. And I guess from the sponsor standpoint, they want us and the commission to be reporting every so often to see how we move through those requests to restrict hunting activity.
Okay.
Good answer. Sort of. Representative Burley?
Oh, I actually somewhat in response to Representative Haas's question, I couldn't offer you any statistics either, but anecdotally, as my kids were growing up and we were trying to find places to go hunt, birds or whatever the case may be, there were times that it became increasingly difficult to find access to properties. And so, to me, what this bill is, it's the only mandate is it's a no net loss mandate to the department or the commission, if you will, that as they're making those determinations, we just want to make sure we try to keep, access open to the public to enjoy this activity. It doesn't, for example, if I'm not mistaken, Bridge Creek, I think it is, wildlife management area by Ukiah, that right now is closed to hunting. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, no, we do have Bridge Creek open for bird hunting, deer hunting, and elk hunting, but then we get into certain periods or times of the year where we'll close it down to hunting or public access simply from a wildlife management standpoint.
Right.
Or go ahead.
And I think that's a case in point on how this would work. It's not telling you that you have to you'd have to open that up unnecessarily. If there's good wildlife management purposes and objectives, you could open it or close it as the case may be. This doesn't change any of that.
No. And Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the other times, for instance, that we might close lands of hunting from our standpoint, for instance, in Bridge Creek, at some point we had kind of an active timber harvest, timber salvage situation, and those areas where we were working, they were close to hunting.
Mm-hmm. Temporarily.
Temporarily.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Byer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To be honest, last night when I kind of looked at this bill, and maybe it was a bad day, I don't know, I wasn't enthusiastic about the bill. I didn't like it at all. And it's good to know that you're here in support of it and that you can work with this. My concern would be down the road, not today or next year, but down the road, do you see this tying your hands at all? As you have mentioned, people starting to move out into more rural areas, we're expanding populations. Do you think this will tie your hands in being able to manage, through events of not your making, loss of hunting lands because people are moving into those areas?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Byer, it's always hard to envision out in the future every set of circumstances, as you know. But my sense on this bill is it's really essentially asking the commission to keep very close close reporting on lands. If we're shifting lands in and out of hunting access, then the public wants to know that. And that's the main emphasis of the bill to me, I guess. Because a lot of times when areas do close to hunting, it's because of discharge firearm issues or other issues that are outside the purview of the commission. Like for instance, federal lands being opened up and being sold in subdivisions. But on mostly on fish and wildlife lands, though, and lands that the commission has purview on, they're mostly our wildlife areas, and I don't see this having a big impact on the department. I think we'll be able to deal with this just fine with the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you. Mr. Sumner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was covered by the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay.
And how could you be responsible for BLM or U.S. Forest Service closing areas to hunting? And obviously, you can't be responsible. But it begs the question, where exactly are you going to get lands to replace lands that you must close because of whatever reason? Where are you going to get those lands to replace?
Madam Chair, Representative Sumner, I think what we do is probably look to our Access to Habitat program, and I think it would be beneficial to know if in kind of the Commission's ongoing keeping track of lands open and closed that they're working on. I mean, if people are starting to see a real reduction of hunting access, particularly on lands that we're managing for various issues, then we are going to have to do some things differently, or maybe beef up the Access to Habitat program. I mean, I guess one thing that Ron mentioned and comes to mind, probably in southern Oregon, our Denman Wildlife Area is part of an old military camp. I think some of you may be familiar with that area, and that's a good example of an area where, you know, hunting, we have hunting there, but the people are really moving in all around that wildlife area, and it's a small wildlife area. And at some point in time, we're going to get more and more pressure to do something different there. I mean, right now, probably 70%, 60% of the use there is hikers, fishermen on the rogue, and that kind of stuff. And that's an example where we see things on our wildlife areas where just because of all the changes that's going on, in the end, a small wildlife area may be difficult to have hunting on.
Yeah.
And if that's getting to be the case, then maybe we need to sell that wildlife area and take that money and go buy a new wildlife area and buy much more acreage, ensure that we're ever going to preserve hunting opportunity for the area, that area of Medford. See, that's kind of the things that, in a way, this gets the Commission thinking about, is how it's going to, you know, small wildlife areas that down the road we're going to have issues with, safety issues, let's say, might not it be better to do something else with that land? And then we go find an area in southern Oregon, much more acreage that we can always have hunting opportunity on. So those are some of the things that this bill brings to mind for the Commission to be thinking about as they manage into the future.
And, Madam Chair,
so in short, you're saying that this bill is not something you dread, but is actually an opportunity. Not to put words
right, Madam Chair, Representative Sumner. No, we don't dread this bill at all. I think it gives the Commission even further direction to be thinking about hunting access issues. And this commission that we have presently is very, very sensitive to those, of course, as is the department. But as you look into the future, you know, I got to say, for instance, up in Washington, up until this last round of new appointments, they have a 9-member Fish and Wildlife Commission. There were no hunters on the commission. Mm. Not one. And that was a sad situation. Now, Governor Gregor has since changed that, and she's changed the whole mix of the commission. But that's the kind of commission that hunters and fishermen dread. So, and that's what this bill gives us a little more direction on, that no matter what has commissions come and go, hunting access is a priority for the department and lands that it manages. And that's what this tells us. And we can do that. We can do that.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to make one clarification on a comment that Representative Sumner made. Outside of migratory birds, the federal government really has no authority to regulate hunting. The state of Oregon does. They do have authority to implement administrative closures for discharge of firearms, and they have done that. But we make it very clear to the Forest Service, BLM, and even other state and county entities that Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is the agency that regulates hunting.
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative Haas?
Thank you. I follow up on Representative Byers' question. She said, you know, what do you do when you run out of land, essentially, with growth? And you responded that it's, you know, this gives you some good reporting work to do. But that's not exactly what the bill says. It does say that, you know, you have to, you must make this land accessible in cases of a net loss.
Okay.
It says must. And, you know, and she's right, you know, this isn't necessarily about next season, but, you know, 20 seasons from now. And it seems to me that kind of puts you into a bind, or the state with this agency in a bind with this law.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Haas,
Well, I guess from an agency perspective, this is not the agency's bill, as you understand. And so the way we have looked at the bill, and you may have a very good point that in the future it might put us in a bind, but the agency position on this bill is that we can live with this bill. We can work with this bill. If the bill passes through, then we feel we can work with it.
Any further follow-up? Seeing no further questions, thank you very much. I have Ed Johnston.
My name is Ed Johnston of Lincoln County. I support this bill totally and completely. We need this. Similar to like another bill I have myself this year is 803 Subsistence Fishery. We need to keep this. We need to look for the future. This is a constitutional right to feed your family. We start regulating, taking more rights away. What are we leaving your grandchildren, my nieces and nephew, and our future? We have to be realistic instead of being regulating ourselves right out of it. The Constitution does exist in this building. This does have effect. The one thing I heard in the testimony was dealing with people buying houses and moving out in these areas. Well, sorry, not the public's problem. The majority of the public, this is a democracy, majority of the public has the right to that land to feed their family. Those people are going to have to make adjustments to the area and be respectful to their neighbors out there instead of being so self-centered and self-serving as we see that goes on in this state on a daily basis. So that is our responsibility out of this building to echo that around the state so we keep our rights to feed our family so we don't lose it and so it doesn't become like a kingdom how this country got started 227 years ago. And if we keep going in the direction we are going, we're going to be doing that. But what bothers me if this bill does not pass is going to be the same thing like last year. ODFNW misled the public with their numbers on the black and blue rockfish. Took away the Oregon Coast constitutional rights to feed their family. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that includes feeding yourself, working, paying your electricity bills, the right of your happiness of your family. The department literally took away the constitutional rights of this state by closing down the bottom fish. And this bill has to pass so we keep our constitution right. This is a democracy. Let's make sure it's a democracy and stays that way instead of controlling interest of a public agency that works for the public. Now, I'm a public person that pays taxes. I pay this privilege. This is a privilege they work. It's not a right. This agency would sit there and form for privilege to this state. Now, we as the people have the right to say that this company, this non-corporation exists or doesn't exist. And they cannot forget, it's a right that they work here. Okay? It's not a privilege that they work here. It is a privilege they work here. It's not a right that they have their jobs. It's a privilege they have their jobs. And when they shut down the bottom fishing last year, it took away our rights to feed ourselves, and I know because I'm one of those people that directly took food out of my mouth. That's how I survive. I don't sit there and all with the feed free pantries all the time and everything. So it took away my right. This bill needs to pass so the next generation has a future. When it comes to BLM and cooperations, yes, we need to make sure that happens because I live on the Oregon coast. I over in the Blue Mountains and hunt a lot in Blue Mountains. ODFNW was part of an agency that traded to a company in Washington, the state of Washington. That's an environmental company. I wish I would have had that fax if I'd known this was here today. But they're based out of Japan, the company is. They bought 10,000 acres over in the Blue Mountains for privatized hunting. They're getting ready to put up 15 to 18 foot fences after they're hoarding our deer and elk into that area. And so they're getting ready to put up fences to corral that. So this is our land. So please pass this bill and look for your future of your grandchildren to make sure that they have the right to feed themselves instead of a dictatorship telling them it's a privilege to eat.
Thank you, Mr. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very
much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here to testify on 2529? Jared? Council?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot with the Oregon Chapters of Safari Club International, here today to wholeheartedly support House Bill 2529. In the interest of time, I'll keep my comments short, but a no net loss of hunting opportunity on public lands is what we're about. Our access to public lands decreases, in our opinion, and like Representative Burley said anecdotally, it's the cases from our members where we hear all the time, you know, we used to have access. We used to have a lot more places to hunt on public land, and that continuously goes away. And we do feel that this provides clear direction to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Commission to make sure that we don't lose more opportunity. I know the department's worked very hard in working with the private landowners and through the Access and Habitat Program to get access to public lands who have been, in some cases, locked up by surrounding private property owners who have public land that they own all the private land around it. So working with those folks to provide that access. So we support this bill, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jared. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Seeing no one else, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2881. 2529. Do it again. Make sure I get it right. Committee, I think I want to wait a few days and kind of let us think about this. There's no doubt on the access to hunting. They made the case very well for that, and I think there was a few questions. And so if maybe sponsors of the bill could work with the committee members and try to get them on feeling more comfortable with it, I think we can go ahead and move this bill.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Can I just make a comment?
Sure.
In response to some of the questions raised by our colleagues on the committee, I want to point out that what this does is it says that these public lands.
I'm going to reopen the public hearing.
Oh, okay.
If you want to make a comment.
Oh, thank you. Okay. You know, it says that the public lands shall be open for access and use of hunting. But it does have an exception in there allowing the commission for reasons of public safety or wildlife management, which, you know, we heard some of earlier. It also points out the commission is not required to give preference to hunting over other uses, which addresses some concerns that you've seen in the written testimony. But I also want to call your attention to Section 2, Sub 2, which is the no net loss paragraph, and it does have the qualifier in there to the greatest extent practicable. And I think that gives the commission some wiggle room if, you know, for whatever reason, as long as it's justified and a sound rationale, they can make those types of decisions, and we could have a reduction in acreage. But what this is saying is it's important, and if you're going to do it, we want to see why and how much it's affecting things.
Thank you, Representative Burley. Representative Cass, you had a comment?
Yes, thank you. Well, that is exactly the section where I do have some problem with, because you're telling managers shall avoid making management determinations that result in this net loss. So, you know, I think wildlife managers who specialize in this should be making the call, not politicians.
I think for yourself, sir.
we're telling managers what to do, and it feels a little bit like micromanagement. It might not, you know, I'm not saying this is the worst thing that can happen, but I just skip pause to that policy.
Thank you. I think he's raised some very good concerns and questions, and that's why I wanted to wait until you spoke with people. But as policymakers, this is a policy that we're looking to correct access and to make sure ensure access for hunting purposes. So, it's huge economic impacts on this state, and that is what we're looking at. So I appreciate that. Any other comments? I'm now going to close a public hearing again on 2529, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2597. Patrick.
Yeah.
And I have Representative Krupp and Crawford here. And Patrick, would you like to fill us in while they make their way?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue. I'll say that now so I don't forget to mention it later. The bill would create a tax credit against income taxes or corporate excise taxes for wage increases paid by employers to farm employees when those wage increases are a result of increases in the minimum wage. The bill limits the tax credit to the amount of taxes paid, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2006. And before January 1, 2012, Included in your packets are dash one amendments, which were received from the Oregon Farm Bureau, I believe, is who submitted those. And there's a hand and gross version of the bill in there. And I believe we'll have our witnesses will speak to those as well.
We have a referral, a subsequent referral.
Yes, the bill has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Thank you. Thank you, Patrick. Welcome. Who wants to go first?
The good representative has generously let me go first because he's really at these campaign forums. I hate candidate forums. I hate following great speakers, so I'll mumble through first. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mike Schaffler, State Representative, District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland. And just I want to give you just a brief history. 2 years ago, we had the minimum wage, cost of living, those painful hearings in our Business, Labor, Consumer Affairs Committee. And I was and we heard from a lot of farmers and ranchers and everybody else, too, that's impacted by it. And I'm a, and since I am a supporter of the laws that's written, I thought, how can I help these folks? And being the son of people that grew up on dairy farms in Minnesota, cousins of dairy farmers in Minnesota, growing up in the Midwest, working with my friends on and neighbors on their farms my whole young life, I really just have a great respect and sincere affection for those that grow things for us to consume here in this country. So I thought, well, how can I help them? And I thought this bill will give them a tax break on the raise in minimum wage after up to a certain point. And then after that, as folks get raised up out of there, then they won't get the minimum wage, the credit anymore. Just for farmers and ranchers. And there's some amendments also in the workers' on, not for retail because and bars and restaurants, because the farmer's in a unique position. Everything they purchase, they have to go out and they buy it on, at retail price, and then the product they create, they are at the whim of markets that are in Chicago, New York, and Tokyo. They can't just go out and put a nickel more on their product. And this will just be one little tiny way to help them defray the cost of what I have supported imposing on them as far as minimum wage workers go. And I just think we need to do everything we can in this state to help agriculture and help these folks that are struggling. It is really a struggle out there. And I'm not an expert on the revenue side of it or the technicalities, but if I'm going to impose something on these folks, I'm going to try and do my best to help them out. And there are some amendments that would allow them to broker these credits, I think, for up to 5 years, and then they would lose them. But I think that I support that friendly amendment. I think it's just something that is going to just add the value of something like this and even further help agriculture here in the state of Oregon. So that's what I'm about, and I'm just going to leave it at that. I will say if anybody wants to ask me a question.
Do we have any questions for Representative? We have people here who are going to explain this, and I'm sure Representative Karp can. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's great to be with you this morning. I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp in House District 17. I'm pleased to be here with Representative Schaffler, who's of the other party than I am. And I think that demonstrates to you a reason why this is a good idea and why you should consider it, is that this is an idea that sort of crosses party lines because of its ultimate effect of the higher minimum wage and its negative impacts on agriculture in so many segments of agriculture. And you'll get some study work, if you haven't seen it already, that will be presented to you about farmers and agricultural people, their impressions of how the minimum wage increases have affected their businesses. And you will find that there are variations there, because not all types of agriculture are as labor intensive as others. But by and large, ultimately, as the increase automatically is indexed on a yearly basis, you will see those disparities in agriculture narrow. You will see the impact of this effect ultimately, I think, dramatically all segments of agriculture. I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer. You know that. The problem with farming is it's very difficult under our marketing structures and in a competing and a changing world economy to be able to pass on the wage increases. So what that necessitates for a farmer like me is to look at what other options I have in the bottom line. If I cannot raise my price of my products that I'm selling, then I have to look at other efficiencies. And typically that means automation, which you can do in some industries and can't others as of yet. But understand, the American ethic is necessity is the mother of invention. And so as wages get higher and higher, you will see individuals go to more automation. You will see new ideas and new technologies emerge that will take the place of human beings. And one only has to look at the foreign competition aspects of not agriculture, but the automotive industry, of where automobiles were being produced in the Orient, Japan, far cheaper than we could, and the only way we could compete with that was to do what? But go to all these wonderful and marvelous robotic technologies now that have replaced so many workers on the production lines of automobile factories. And you're going to see that, in fact, you are seeing it today. If you've been driving around Salem, any into the farmlands, you're seeing all of these new automated irrigation systems go up everywhere. In fact, in my years of farming, this is the highest rate of irrigation center pivot systems coming into being, of linear systems, which are the same but move in a straight line. And it's for two reasons. It's because of the higher minimum wage, which is the reason that I did this some years ago on my own farm, but also because the federal government now has put a new program in place for water conservation as these systems are more efficient. So farmers are taking advantage of that. What does that mean? It means less workers in the fields. Less jobs for kids when they get out of school in June to get one of those jobs moving irrigation pipe, which is what I did and so many did. And I think you did too, Representative, didn't you?
Pipe. I bucked a lot of hay and shoveled.
There you go. So.
Still shoveling today.
You know, I really have a story to go. Forgive me, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Representative. I have to say, you know, schaufel is shovel in German. And schaufler means shoveler. Now, I'm a concrete contractor in labor my whole life, so my name was very applicable and fitting for my job. Well, now I become a politician, and it's still very fitting. It's right in there, so forgive me.
Representative, I call myself a public servant, not a politician. The bottom line here is that the Oregon agriculture every year seems to face some new challenge as it relates to labor. And I will give you the example of last year. Bureau of Labor and Industries under former Representative Dan Gardner decided to remove agriculture's exemption, which we've had from the beginning, on meal and rest periods required under the law for everyone else, but ag was exempted for the very reasons of the uniqueness of how we harvest crops, and you have such a small window to do those typically in the agricultural industry. He removed those, so now those are required of farmers and nurserymen. They have to track those. They have to deliver those. And it's another increasing cost. It's a mandate that was passed on to us farmers. So every time that happens, and you add that to a higher, ever-increasing minimum wage, you make it harder for a farmer to make a profit, and then he goes, in his mind, a farmer says, okay, what am I going to do to remain in business? What is it that I need to do because my margins are so thin? Because I can't pass the cost on, what do I need to do? And in some cases, they will change their mix of crops. I no longer grow peppermint or pumpkins for edible seed because of labor issues, because of international trade issues. I just can't do it profitably anymore. I just grow grass seed now, and that's becoming overproduced. So what you will see is you will see farmers choose to grow different crops. In fact, they will gravitate to other states. And this is a competition issue to some extent, because Idaho has a much lower minimum wage. It is not indexed. It's at the federal level. And what that means is that some of the crops that are grown here in Oregon, farmers, I know farmers that are literally selling their farms and are going to Idaho. Now, that doesn't happen a lot, but it is a trend that's starting to happen more and more. And so the point of this bill is to make it easier for Oregon agriculture to deal with the higher minimum wage, so that we can be competitive in a world market, we can be competitive with some of our neighbors, and literally we can retain some jobs. Every time you increase our costs, jobs loss are going to be the result, and that again is in your packet, and it's the reality, and I can speak from that from a farmer's perspective. And I know that many of the other individuals in the room that are also share in ownership of agricultural businesses will tell you the same thing. Ultimately, we have to have some help to be able to deal with this. And if we don't, ultimately, I don't know how we deal with it, other than, I suppose, some of us will simply choose to go into other occupations entirely. And with that, Madam Chair, I would hope that the committee, I'm very much in support of the amendments, and would hope that you would refer this bill out to the next level. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? No?
Yes.
Yes,
thank
Representative Burley. I couldn't tell.
Just curious, would this apply to the practice of vermiculture?
I don't know. We want to regulate everything. I voted against that, so. But, Madam Chair, I believe 2 years ago, I think it was only $1 million impact on our revenue. I haven't got the revenue impact yet. But I just... You know, every little thing we can do to help, and some of the things Representative was talking about, I supported those mandates too. And I'm saying to myself, if I support these impositions, how can I help this industry and the families out there that are in it at the same time? And I think that's the kind of perspective that we need in this building. If we're going to do something and it has an impact on somebody, first of all, we have to justify it. Second, if we can find a way to make it less of an impact or make that impact go away, would be great. We should look for those things, and I think this does that. There are going to be some folks come up, some good friends of mine, maybe, they did 2 years ago, and oppose this because they're afraid it'll keep people at minimum wage. It'll incent the farmer to keep people at minimum wage. The vast majority of employees are not on minimum wage, and they quickly move up if they're a good employee. So that really doesn't... I don't agree with that argument, but I just wanted to share that with you, just in case my good friends do come up and say that.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I might add, I not only concur with Representative Schaffler, but would add in the fact that there is this increasing dynamic here of as the minimum wage is indexed every year, then it gets quickly to a point where you have disparities for younger workers. I'm talking high school kids who come out and drive tractor and combine in the grass fields, which is what I'm most familiar with. Your older workers have been there for a while, and they've done exactly what he said. They've rose through the ranks. They've showed themselves to be responsible. So they come back summer after summer to the farmer, and the farmer pays them a little more. Now all of a sudden you've bumped up the lower tier of first or second year kids who are coming into work, and then it means you've got to bump the other, because if you don't, then you have an equalization that takes effect and you get unhappy employees. And so again, what it does is it increases your costs. Mandates without incentives to offset them for some of their negative consequences are usually not a good thing. In my opinion, I oppose them. If there are incentives to offset the damage that some mandates create, and this is one of those mandates, and agriculture is one of these industries that can't pass the cost along. When you're producing cars and you negotiate for a higher wage with your union, you pass the cost along to the consumer. But you can't do it in agriculture. The markets don't work that way. Mm-hmm. And this is an appropriate idea, in my opinion, to offset a mandate with an incentive that helps mitigate that damage. And again, I think you should consider it.
Thank you. Representative Sumner?
Thank you. Not a question, more of a statement, if you please. I know if farmers do away with expensive hand work, hand labor, then they'll mechanize their farm.
Sure.
And because of their purchase of the equipment, they're allowed to write it off their taxes in form of depreciation. Mm-hmm. And it would occur to me that there's a very similar there's a very similar scenario here, that if farmers are allowed to write off portions of that labor expense, then that will encourage them to keep producing the products that we need in the state and are dependent on from other states and other countries ever more every day. I like the concept of this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Sumner is absolutely correct. The federal tax code changes in the last few years have created another dynamic that comes into play with this higher minimum wage scenario. It's very simply that it is to your advantage to buy newer equipment that's more mechanized, that's more efficient, because you get this tremendous tax benefit from it. And what that then means, that's part of the farmer's decision-making process. You've got labor issues, BOLI, you've got higher minimum wage, and you weigh that against buying a more efficient piece of equipment that maybe takes the place of two workers. And that becomes that equation that the farmer makes in his mind, and he makes a decision. If you buy the new piece of equipment, that stimulates the economy in one area of manufacturing, but we lose jobs, typically entry-level jobs for a lot of high school kids that are seasonal jobs. We lose that, and we lose the income tax revenue as the state of Oregon. And you don't get it replaced. When my dad bought his new John Deere combine, not new, but almost new John Deere combine last year, he could expense $100,000 of that in 1 year. And that replaced two combines, and it took one of his employees away. And he made that decision last year for that very reason. Because he's tired of the hassle of employees. He's tired of all of that scenario. So what happened there? He spent a bunch of money that went to John Deere's manufacturing facility, basically back in Moline, Illinois. And we lost tax revenue from income tax of keeping somebody employed during a summertime job. And so those are the dynamics that are going to come into play here. That's why this is a reasonable idea. And it's if society has said we're going to have a higher minimum wage, and they have, then this is a good way to deal with it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would like to add, too, it would be great if we could find some land and create and get John Deere to build one of them plants right here in Oregon with good United Auto Workers staffing their production lines.
Amen, Representative. Well spoken.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Madam Chair. Thank you.
We have quite a few people signed up. Scott Ashcombe, do you want to come up? Oregon Agricultural Alliance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Scott Ashcombe with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. We're a general farm organization. Represent production agricultural growers in the state of Oregon. Most of the members of the Ag Alliance are large employers with 50 or more full-time employees. And so the minimum wage COLA automatic adjustment, it hurts them every year. You're going to hear from a bunch of farmers. You're going to hear from a lot of people a lot smarter on this issue than me. So I'm going to fall quiet in a minute. Let me just point out my written testimony contains as an attachment the Farm Bureau amendments, the Dash 1 amendments, which we support. They make a good bill even better. Then I have attached the complete study done by Oregon Department of Agriculture on the impact of the minimum wage and COLA adjustment on Oregon agricultural jobs. And so you have that document. You don't need to hear me repeat it. I just would like to quote from the ODA study, however, and it's on page 2 of my written testimony. The study says, the major concerns identified by respondents to the survey included four broad categories. One, many producers are unable to pass on costs directly affecting bottom line and economic viability of the business. Two, competition takes place in national and international marketplace. The higher labor costs in Oregon place agricultural business in a particularly difficult competitive position, and some are losing markets or customers. Three, higher minimum wages have implications and impacts on job opportunities for young people and less experienced workers. Four, increased labor costs are forcing decisions that are resulting either directly or indirectly in lower employment due to increased mechanization, delaying hiring or layoffs. And the testimony concludes that in the state of Washington and in the state of Oregon in the previous 2 years, the U.S. Department of Labor and USDA found that there have been 7,000 jobs lost to agriculture in the state of Washington and Oregon. Washington has a similar minimum wage COLA adjustment. So that's the position we're coming from. This bill is a piece of legislative relief which agriculture sorely needs in the state of Oregon. We want to thank Representative Krupp and Representative Schaffler for agreeing to give us a note from Mother and get us in legislative council and get this bill introduced in the session of the legislature. And we want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for providing us an opportunity to pitch this bill to you and hopefully get it sent down to Revenue with a due pass.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Any questions? I have just one question.
Yes.
Are Oregon and Washington the two highest states for minimum wage?
I believe they are, yes.
Okay, thank you. Don Schellenberg, Barry Bichoux, Oregon Farm Bureau. We have to be on the floor at 11, so I'm just kind of reminding everybody. Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Don Schellenberg representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for holding a hearing today on House Bill 2597. In recent years, through the ballot measure process, Oregon voters have increased the Oregon minimum wage two times. The last time, a most significant change was made by adding an automatic indexing provision that requires the wage to increase annually based on the increase in the urban CPI. What the drafters of the measure failed to realize is that the consumer price index in rural Oregon related to labor costs and other production inputs is very different than metropolitan Oregon. The result is that agriculture is faced with unrealistic increasing labor costs while trying to compete with our counterparts in other states and in a world market where there's no relativity to the CPI in Portland. I mention this background not because House Bill 2597 alters the minimum wage or the indexing provision, but because it outlines the problem that is plaguing Oregon's agriculture producers. The Oregon Farm Bureau and others have tried during past legislative sessions to adjust the indexing issue, but to no avail. And thanks to Representative Schaffler, Representative Krupp, and even Representative Brown, who had input, we come to you today with a fresh new approach that solves the problem without harming the worker. In fact, the Dash 1 amendments before you make it possible for producers to employ more workers. And Representative Krupp talked about that very eloquently. House Bill 2597, as amended, provides for a tax credit equal to the portion of the minimum wage that is due to the indexing provision of the minimum wage law. In other words, today the producer would earn a tax credit of 35 cents for each hour of wages paid for agricultural labor. The producer then can deduct that from their tax liability at the end of the year, in effect recouping the increased labor cost for the year due to indexing. There are times, however, lean years, when a producer may not have a tax liability and the credit cannot be utilized. The amendments provide that the credit or any portion of it or an accumulated amount may be used during the succeeding 5 years. The amendments also provide that if the producer is not in a financial position to wait until tax time to use the full value of the credit may be sold to another party for a negotiated amount less than its full value. I believe it's very easy to see the value in this new approach. The workers are paid the highest possible wage because there is no wage indexing disincentive. The producer now has capital to employ additional workers or pay the existing workers even more, depending on the needs of the business. And the economy of Oregon grows because more people are working or working at a higher wage. This proposal is not just the customary win-win situation. It's a trifecta. Chair Smith, members of the committee, besides Oregon Farm Bureau, President Barry Bichoux is here at the table with me today. There are a number of other producers in the audience here today who support this bill. Some of them may wish to offer their perspective in this proposed solution. I would say in closing that at the recent Farm Bureau Labor Advisory Committee meeting, the members stated that the resolution of this issue would do more for the well-being of agriculture than any other issue under consideration. Therefore, Farm Bureau asks that you adopt the Dash 1 amendments and send House Bill 2597 to the House Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Bichoux. I'm the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau and a full-time farmer in Representative Patty Smith's district. The concept of tax and other incentives for job creation and stability is nothing new. The high-tech industry has taken advantage of it for years. Agriculture employs approximately 1 in 12 people either directly on farms or in related industries. Oregon was founded and established by farmers, ranchers, and foresters, and we remain a key component of the state's economy. The indexation of the minimum wage based on an urban CPI puts Oregon's agriculture at a distinct disadvantage. We are, for the most part, price takers, not price makers. The majority of Oregon's ag products are exported to other states and internationally, and yet we have the second highest minimum wage in the nation. A poster child for this issue is the closure of the sugar plant in Nissa, Oregon, and the transfer of its operation to a sister plant in Nampa, Idaho, where the minimum wage is $5.15 an hour without indexation. The concept of a tax credit provisions would not impact the payrolls of our employees, but would offer us incentives to maintain and increase our labor force. Many of us have long-term permanent employees. Most are paid considerably more than minimum wage. If wages are based on profitability or productivity, then a common practice is to try and keep those employees on the payroll even during slack times of the year. When wages become as much as 60% of your operational costs, this becomes impossible. Arbitrary indexation creates an artificial level of automatic guarantees of wage increase, which forces pay increases through all employees, which is exponentially higher for your top-level, more experienced employees. Ever ratcheting up farmers' costs with no relevance to the ability to either improve your profitability or offset it. Oregon Farm Bureau believes that a solution is warranted. This tax compromise is a win-win. We can only hope agriculture becomes profitable enough to take advantage of it. I appreciate the time and will answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have to be on the floor at 11, so I'm going to try to call some people that I think drove here. Kathy Femright? Femright Nursery?
Thank you for this opportunity to discuss this this bill.
You need to state your name.
Kathy Femright. My husband and I own Femright Nursery Company in Aurora. I'll just briefly tell you a little bit about how this has affected our nursery so far. The cost of labor and related costs are half of our total expenses. So when something like this happens that has a major effect on that cost, it is a big difference for us. The related costs are payroll taxes and workers' comp insurance and other benefits like health insurance. And the minimum wage doesn't only just go up for the people at the bottom of the wage. We also raise rates for everyone that that we employ in a similar manner. We have to budget our costs by July 1st every year, so this cost is an unpredictable one that makes it difficult for us. We have had to lower some benefits. For example, we renewed our health insurance this last February, and we chose a lower cost plan that raised the deductible for our employees. That just creates more cost for them. We are right now hiring fewer people because we have to stay within our budget, and labor is such a huge part of it. We are doing some other things too to change the people that we employ. We have done some mechanization in the last few years. One of them is drip irrigation, which is tape that's under the ground near the roots of our plants, which has taken away five jobs that we used to use all summer long for to move irrigation pipe and so forth. Now we have one person that does that all the time. I'd also like to mention that the Willamette Valley is unique in its climate and soils for farming. I think most everyone knows that already, but I wanted to remind you that in this situation. We ship into 40 states and four other countries, so we're bringing new dollars into the state, but we also buy most of our supplies within Oregon, so the dollars do stay here. I think that's pretty much what I need to tell you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Beyer.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for being here. Do you have kind of a rough estimate of what percentage of your employer base is minimum wage versus over minimum wage?
We probably have 50 people that work for us year-round. And then we probably have another 20 that come in seasonally, and probably the 20 are the ones that would be at minimum wage. And if they stay, then they move up. But, and our year-round people are all above minimum wage.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rod Park. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good to see you again.
You too.
I dressed a little differently, and I did. Should I squeal that you did buy some kind of John Deere product? Sorry.
I'm a farmer on weekends.
Evenings.
Well, Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Rod Park. I currently own and operate Parks Nursery in Gresham, Oregon. I'm also past president of the Oregon Association of Nurserymen and a former chair of the Oregon Board of Agriculture. I currently serve as a metro counselor for District 1, which includes part of eastern portion of the Portland metro region from Gresham to Troutdale to Happy Valley, Damascus. As a matter of fact, the back end of my property, if I was just over the line, I would be in the chair's district. And part of my metro district, however, overlaps hers. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. I'm here to urge you to support House Bill 97 to support agriculture, which is a very important part of Oregon's traded sector economy. 2597 will help give Oregon Oregon's agriculture a much needed shot in the arm. As many of you know, the state's agricultural base is in trouble. We are seeing a decline in food processing, and segments have seen decline in profitability due to offshore competition and other increased costs such as energy. The nursery industry is not immune to these trends either. I, like most Oregon nurseries, ship over 80% of our material out of state. I'm proud to say that Oregon is the third largest producer of nursery products at over $750 million annually. We have a national and international reputation of growing superior plants. We, however, compete against competitors closer to the market on the East Coast, and the rising costs of production are eroding our ability to compete. Our transportation costs have soared with the recent spikes in oil prices and the shortage of trucking. This is something we do have little control over, or the state has. The area where the state can help, however, is in labor, which is a very large component of our cost of production. Oregon voters have spoken and said Oregon will have a wage structure that will pace the nation. While a laudable goal, it ignores the economic reality that other parts of the country, those areas which we compete, and I'm speaking on behalf of the nursery industry segment, will take the very jobs and businesses they sought to protect. Labor is approximately 35-40% of my cost of sales, and I suspect that is about average for my competitors within the state. When you factor in the other cost of production, such as fuel, fertilizers, chemicals, equipment, etc., well, the return on investment makes one wonder about the future. As a grower and a leader in agriculture, I am very concerned about the trend of Oregon's farming. As a metro counselor, I am concerned about the reason we are protecting farmland when farming is slowly being strangled by one impediment after another. I would urge your support of this bill to keep agriculture and the nursery industry a viable and a very vibrant part of Oregon's economy. As heard earlier, we do need to level the playing field. Thank you.
I'll
take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Park. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very
much.
Thank you. Nice to see you again, too. John McCauley.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCauley. I'm here representing the tree fruit industry today. These are the apple, pear, and cherry growers in the Mid-Columbia area in southern Oregon and Jackson County, and in northeastern Oregon, the apple growers in Umatilla County near Milton Freewater. We're here today to support House Bill 2597. As you might imagine, the tree fruit industry is a very labor-intensive industry, with each tree having personal attention paid to it at least twice a year, once during pruning and once during harvest time. And it is an industry where there aren't very many alternatives. You just don't replace an orchard and plant wheat. So for the long term, we expect that labor is going to be a major issue in that industry. We believe that 2597 is a very reasonable approach to dealing with the minimum wage issue that has been contentious in these halls over the past couple of sessions. And we think it's worthwhile sending it down to the Revenue Committee. We also support the Dash 1 amendments. The approach that's taken in the Dash 1 amendments are very similar to incentives used in the Farm Labor Housing Tax Credit, which has been very successful in creating more and better housing for farm workers. So we think that this is a worthwhile bill to have the Revenue Committee consider and urge your support.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Is it Mike or Mark Krautman?
Yes, Mark.
Mark, hi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Krautman with Heritage Seedlings right here in Salem. We have a nursery business about 24 years old. We started it basically from scratch. Of course, we started it with our own labor and that of entry-level workers. I like to think of my employees, those who come on early in the stage, as entry-level rather than minimum wage. I think it dignifies their role in our company as I see it. My wife and I own the company, and our effort to upgrade our business is dependent upon our upgrading the performance of our employees, because after all, if we don't take care of them, we can't take care of our customers. Given your information that our industry produces a value-added product which is exported out of state, our challenge is really twofold. On the one hand, we're mechanizing all the time like any business to become more efficient, but I'd ask you to consider another aspect of this. We have also a different strategy in which we actually employ more hand labor as part of our strategic growth plans. And I could give you an example. We started our business growing rootstocks and seedling material. In recent 4 or 5 years, we've moved toward production of more value-added product, including grafted material. And I know you have limited time, so I'll be brief, but essentially I could give you this example. If we take a rootstock and we graft that with a different plant to produce a more ornamental item, that requires more hand labor, not less. I can't mechanize that by buying a piece of John Deere equipment or any kind of equipment. So while we're mechanizing, we're also adding value to our product so that we can charge more for it, and we do use hand labor to do that, entry-level labor. We try to bring these folks in, teach them a skill, bring them on up through the ranks, and improve their quality of life along with our own. So we see that as a pairing of our interests and theirs as well. You've heard that the industry is among our most robust in the agricultural economy. I would just like to add that this bill I support, our industry supports, because it helps to keep us vigorous and the state of Oregon's economy vigorous by maintaining those jobs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Byer has a question.
Oh, sure. Sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Happen to be in the middle of a landscaping project at my house. Spent a lot of time in nurseries lately, and it's kind of amazing how expensive it is to buy plants. And I'm kind of curious about profit margins. What kind of profit margins you can expect?
Do I detect a conflict of interest?
Well, of course, every business has a different experience here in that regard. We try to increase our make a 20% margin so that we can grow our company. We, of course, carry a lot of items that are our strategic vision of our own company is to lead the market rather than follow the market or take a price, as you have heard. And so we try to price our product as much as we can get for it, and then wait and see, can we sell it? Many of the items that we grow, we carry for 5 or 6 years before we can make a profit at it. For example, we just started a new perennial enterprise. And unlike the other growers of perennials, we're not growing the ones that are out there on the market. We're introducing all kinds of brand new, in fact, Willamette Valley native perennials into the market here in the Northwest. So our hope is that, Representative Byer, you can go into a garden center and find some of Oregon's own native plants in the future. And we want to grow enough of those that we can make a fair margin, try to make a margin in the 20% region, and then sell a lot of those plants so that you can go find one when you come to the garden center.
Okay. One more?
Sure.
Quickly. The question I asked before, I guess I will rephrase it a little bit. How many, you might have said this, how many employees do you have and how many of them are entry level?
We have 60 employees, and I did some calculations in anticipation of this question. We have 35 entry level people making between minimum wage and $8.50 or $9 an hour. And so at that rate, we are, I calculated out, paying 84,000 hours of entry level labor in our company right here in Salem. And if you do the calculations, you'll come up with about a $610,000 annual cost out of our $1.3 million labor expense per year. So if you start looking at the minimum wage there, even in the past 2 years, it's added $40,000 to our additional costs. Now, you may say, well, in a $1.3 million labor bill, that's not a lot. But what happens is, as this index is in, the spread gets greater and greater between what we pay and what they pay in other states that are at $5.15 an hour, federal minimum. It really limits our ability to compete and to build new business into our company with a brand new endeavor that expands our company and grows our revenue and the employment base of the state.
One just quick follow-up on that. And of your entry level, are they most of those seasonal?
We have no seasonal employees, although this year I will almost certainly not rehire or keep the four people that we hired. We typically hire three or four new people every year, and we'll keep two or three of those. We're quite selective in whom we employ, so they like to stay, and we would like to keep them. Typically, we keep two out of three or three out of four. This year, I probably won't keep any of them because I see this trend becoming a, you know, I can't maintain that.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't called Bob Schaefer. Sean Miller, do you guys want to come up? Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I represent the Pacific Northwest Christmas Tree Association. And with me today is Bob Schaefer of Noble Mountain Tree Farms. And Madam Chair, we, the association supports House Bill 2597 along with the -1 amendments. And in the Christmas tree industry, we also compete with other regions of the United States, particularly Michigan and North Carolina, who are the other markets of Christmas trees. And both of those states have much lower minimum wages than our state. And with me today, Bob will just share an example of the committee on the impacts of this indexing of the minimum wage on his particular farm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Schaefer. I'm general manager of Noble Mountain Tree Farm. We're a large Christmas tree operation. We have holdings around the Salem area, and I'm here on behalf of Noble Mountain in support of House Bill 2597. We currently employ over 90 employees. Christmas trees are a very labor-intensive crop. You've heard testimony about mechanization. It's been tried in our industry. If you don't want to grow a quality product, you can do it. But if you want to grow a quality product, you're going to have to do it by hand. I calculated our lost sales last harvest season to other regional competitors. Our company lost $575,400 in sales last year, 2004, to Michigan and North Carolina growers. And it looks like it's going to go up this year. And that's a heck of a hit, not only for our company, but for the economy of the region. Christmas tree growers' costs are pretty much the same. You have chemicals, fertilizer, land values are about the same, supplies are about the same. The big cost is labor. It costs growers in our state about $10, relatively speaking, to grow a crop. our major competing regions, which would be Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina, it costs them about $8, and that difference is labor. And it's really starting to impact our industry, and it significantly impacted our company this last season. And so we do support any help we can get. I really want to thank the committee for hearing this bill and recognizing, and I hope you recognize the importance of any help we can get in Oregon agriculture. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator, would you just comment quickly on foreign competition? Obviously, I continue to hear from growers. We're seeing them growing Christmas trees in other countries, starting to compete with them when labor is less expensive. Could you comment on that at all?
We do have Mexico that has, and I'll be frank with you. I mean, our company has stopped its growth since the minimum wage has been increased. We went to Mexico. I've been in the mountains of Mexico, and they are growing Christmas trees down there. And it's scary to see because there's a company down there that is huge. I mean, they got way too much money, and they're just jumping in with both feet. It's going to impact us. From a grower standpoint, my kids are grown. They're finally in college. You know, I'd actually consider going down there. It's a beautiful part of the world. They're paying $8 a day. When they have when they have tough times getting labor, they're paying $14, and that's a tough one to beat. But they are growing in Mexico. They're going through an oversupply situation in Europe, basically England, Ireland, Denmark. The freight is probably going to keep them from reaching the West Coast. But our problem is that we're basically relatively isolated geographically in terms of the United States. We need to reach that midsection of the country, and you tack freight on top of our cost of growing the tree, and we just can't meet the prices that Michigan and North Carolina in particular can throw out against us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, Piper Sweeney. Did I say that correct?
You did.
Thank you. And then I have Billy Townsend as the last one.
And I will be brief. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for hearing this testimony. My name is Piper Sweeney, and I'm from Country Heritage Farms. We have a family farm in Dayton. We currently employ about 20 seasonal workers and 4 full-time year-round workers. For more than 20 years, we grew broccoli on our farm. And when the minimum wage began to rise, the profits plummeted, really. We went from a real high income, highly perishable crop, where you got into the fields in May, you didn't get out of those fields until late September or mid-September, and it's just every day. On any given day, based on the weather, you can lose a crop in 4 to 8 hours. The entire planting. And so it's just, it was always a gamble. It was always a lot of hard work, but it also allowed us to employ 50 people. Well, as minimum wage has risen, we got to a point where we broke even on broccoli 1 year, and we were one of NORPAC's best growers. We broke even 1 year, and we lost money 1 year. And it was the year that we lost money that I said, okay, you know, it's enough. And we decided not to grow broccoli, so now we're down to 20 employees. Well, with this indexing that is tied to, you know, metropolitan consumer price index, it has nothing to do with what our, you know, economy is like in rural Oregon. And so we're looking now, our last meeting we discussed, you know, the goal of being down to 8 employees. So 50 to 8. It's changing crops, it's mechanization, it's all the things we can do so that we can stay in business. And so this particular amendment will help us to be able to possibly continue to employ the people that we have now on an ongoing basis. Most of our employees are return employees. We have only the new people will get minimum wage, and then they move up from there. But the higher that minimum wage goes, the less able we're really to go ahead and make that adjustment for someone who's been there 2 or 3 years. So we're really struggling, and we need this to stay in business. And I know we're not alone. I think this room would be packed completely if it was a different time of year. I mean, I think it's that critical. So I appreciate you listening to the testimony and considering this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Billy Townsend.
I'm going to try a different chair.
You're so nice. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, I don't do very well at these type of things, so I'm here to support 2597.
For the record, you need to speak.
Oh, sorry, for the record, okay. Billy Townsend from Townsend Farms, okay. Owner and employee. I'm here to support House Bill 2597. Anything that has to do with wage is a tough issue for me because we wouldn't have anything if it wasn't for our people. Everybody here today has stated on a lot of great things, and I couldn't say it any better. We have about a $10 million seasonal payroll. We bulged about 2,000 employees in two production plants, one in Woodburn and one in Fairview, Oregon. We farm about 1,400 acres throughout Oregon and Washington, and I'm the fourth generation, and usually that's the one that loses it. Well, I don't want to be the one to lose it because I learned from the best, and he's not here today, and that's my dad in our business. And I'm not going to settle for second best. I'm going to keep going. We need hands to survive. We need hands. We need to stay quality driven, and that's one thing we have on the foreign markets. That's what I do. All I know is how to sell berries. That's what my dad does. My grandpa told me work hard, Bill, and money will take care of itself, but you know, we need some help, too. We're the one employing these people. We're taking the risk. We're paying our taxes. We're creating jobs. And we need people. We need people. There's only so much in our business that we could do to mechanize, to continue to make a profit. We need the hand labor for the commodities that we grow to stay profitable. I don't see... My question to you folks is, I don't see how you can tie a minimum wage to a consumer pricing index in the state of Oregon if you take a three-leg stool, ag, high-tech, and forestry, and you take away ag and that stool falls over. Look at the high-tech just in my area in the last 5 years. You've had LSI. They're gone. They had promises of all these employees. They're no longer there with the big tax breaks in Gresham. You have about a $10 million building sitting on the corner of Hogan and Halsey in Gresham that sits vacant next to LSI. LSI's, there's nothing new there. But we have a long-term history in the state of Oregon, agriculture does. And we need to keep it here. We need to keep it here, and we need to continue to grow the jobs here. Because if it ever comes down to a trade war someday, people, if it ever comes down to it, how would you guys like China holding a gun to your head by taking away our right to grow our food for the people here in the United States? You take our right away to farm, and we have a trade war with Canada, with Mexico, with China. How would you like them to hold the gun to us? Okay? Automobiles is one thing, but food, things we feed our families and our children, okay? We need to keep it here. We need to keep it in Oregon. Oregon is an agriculture state. That's all I have. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Townsend. Any questions for Mr. Townsend? Thank you very much.
Yep.
I think you did very well. I want you to know I'm from the forestry business. Thank you. I don't have anybody else signed up to testify on this bill. 2597, is there anyone else? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2597 and committee. We're out of time, but I plan to revisit this very soon. So we will do something else. Thank you. And we are adjourned. Thank you.